Hi, I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in just a moment, a conversation with award-winning journalist Colin Woodard on River to River. But before that, of course, you know we've been trying to meet our goal of $325,000 by Monday evening without interrupting programming. We've been doing a magnificent job, but we have to pick up the pace a little bit in order to meet that goal without interrupting programming. Otherwise, if we don't, we go to a traditional pledge drive to finish it up, and we don't want to do that. A traditional pledge drive, of course, means we do interrupt programming, so help us avoid as much of that as possible. Call now with your pledge of support, 800-235-2665. That's 800-235-2665. Of course, you can give online. That's even a little bit faster. Give online at iowapublicradio.org. Listener support is our largest single source of revenue. Make this investment right now. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. How do we best reconcile individual liberty with the maintenance of a free society? That's the question at the heart of award-winning writer and journalist Colin Woodard's new book, American Character, A History of the Epic Struggle Between Individual Liberty and the Common Good. In it, Woodard traces centuries of American history in search of that sweet spot between libertarian and collectivist. He's the author of four previous books, including American Nations and The Republic of Pirates. Currently, he's the state and national affairs writer at the Portland Press Herald and the Maine Sunday Telegram. A longtime foreign correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor and the San Francisco Chronicle, Woodard has reported for more than 50 countries on seven continents. And he joins us once again here on River to River. Colin Woodard, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me back. It's a pleasure.
So let's get right into this, because on this program, we do talk a lot about political conflict, and this political season is of course, no exception, and even more extreme in many senses. But it is often said that we pit liberals and conservatives against each other, elitists or against hardworking Americans, Democrats versus Republicans. But you make the point early in your book that this way sows confusion. Explain, first of all, why this is confusing, perhaps, before we get on to the thrust of your theme here.
Yes, I mean, all of those traditional ways of defining politics and trying to analyze them are difficult, especially if you're trying to look over any kind of time scales, because the Democrats and Republicans have actually exchanged their constituencies, their regional constituencies, and a lot of their platform over the past 100 years, which makes comparing what was going on in, say, 1916 and what's going on today extremely fraught. But also the terms liberal and conservative have become rather confused. You know, you go back to somebody like the great father of conservatism in the English context, Edmund Burke, who's, you know, was concerned about radical change and needed to conserve tradition. He's sort of the father of conservatism back in that time period, the revolutionary era. And what would he make, you know, if conservatives today in the American context are trying to bring down and change the 70-year status quo of the sort of greater New Deal order, where would Edmund Burke fall on that? You know, if you're changing them, you know, based on a abstract theory of human nature, those are the kind of things that Burke, when he looked at the French Revolution, was worried about. Same with the term liberal, which back then and in the European context still kind of means libertarian, and it sort of changes over time in the American context. So those terms are really confusing, and left and right are even more so. So I was looking for a way of better clarity to really understand the American argument in American politics, and to understand it in a question about the differences in how you define freedom. And the critical question in the middle is, you know, when individual liberty and the common good and the maintenance of the community's freedom come into conflict, which side do you err on? And that gives you a spectrum, which if you run out in both directions, gives you a libertarian side and a collectivist side. And the book unpacks our experience and also makes a strong argument that the trick to maintaining, you know, a liberal democracy, the possibility of hopefully universal individual liberty, not that you run in either extreme, but you you find the equilibrium point between those two very important aspects of freedom.
Okay, I want to ask you in just a moment what happens when we go either way too far, and there are points in history that you point to in your book where we can see where that happened. I want to invite our listeners to join our conversation with Colin Woodard, talking about American character, his book, A History of the Epic Struggle Between Individual Liberty and the Common Good, 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook. Before we do get to those extremes, perhaps you could give us a little bit of the sense of the origins of this question of human freedom that you recount in your book. Where did we get these ideas when we talk about societies within the last few hundred years?
Yeah, well, I think it's often forgotten that this aspiration to create a free society, a liberal democracy where ideally, you know, most or all people are able to exercise autonomy and individual freedom, that wasn't even on the agenda for almost the totality of human history. Even in the 5,000 years where we've had complex civilizations, that wasn't even on the agenda. You know, it was collectivism and the idea of people being part of a community or an organic, you know, body that was the society or the kingdom was the norm in Europe, and autocracy and despotism have been the norm throughout our history until quite recently. It's only in the past three or four centuries that the idea that this might be an aspiration for humans was really being articulated, and we've been experimenting with it with mixed success ever since. So it's a remarkable human accomplishment that we've able to create societies where this is possible, and it requires a great deal of civic and public infrastructure and the development and cultivation of citizens who can, you know, act as the key decision makers in a republic, which the theorists of republicanism and democracy have talked about at length. But we often forget that this is not the normal state of affairs. There's nothing natural about it. It's a great human accomplishment and one of our species' greatest, but it requires, you know, it's not a mature forest. It's a garden requiring maintenance and careful cultivation, along, you know, one of those things being the balance between those forces I talked about before.
Okay, so let's talk about, in the pursuit of human freedom, this relatively new concept, relatively new in human existence, the past few hundred years, and how individual liberty and the freedom of the community, the common good, fit into that. And you put those at sort of opposite ends of the spectrum here. Let's go and talk about what happens when we have too much collectivism, in your view. What can you point to there? Go ahead.
As you leave the middle of that spectrum and you start working your way into sort of communitarian realms, and pretty soon you'll get to social democracy, which I think is sort of forgotten exactly what that means, but that's where you have a vigorous free enterprise economy that is supporting through strong taxation a vigorous set of social institutions and protections that are designed and, you know, sort of engineered to try to have better outcomes for that society. That's where a lot of our peer liberal democracies in Western Europe ended up as a starting place. It's been somewhere that Americans have generally been uncomfortable with. You keep going further down the spectrum, you get to socialism, where the state actually owns the mines and the factories and the chunky means of production. You go further into more orthodox socialist states, and pretty soon the state owns everything, every restaurant and every store and every civic association. And as you keep going further down that common good collectivist direction, history has shown that what ends up happening is individuals, especially individual ideas and idiosyncrasies and unorthodox concepts and dynamism, become the keepers of the common good. And there starts being an effort to suppress that sort of thing, where individuals can create, you know, can be accused of thought crimes, and where they're supposed to essentially surrender to the great superego of the party or the fatherland or whatever is keeping the common good. At the extreme, you end up with Orwell and with Stalin's Soviet Union and Hitler's Germany. So obviously that's a bad thing and a rather tyrannical thing. But the trick is that if you go in the other direction, the same thing happens.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's stay with collectivism for a moment, because you and I have something in common here. When we were in our 20s, you traveled outside of the United States. You write in your book, for the first time, traveled to Eastern Europe, as I did in the 20s, and the year was 1989. Little did we know that we would be witnessing the fall of the Soviet Union and the East Bloc countries. You
Absolutely.
Saw there the death throes of this huge collectivist experiment known as the Soviet Union and its satellites.
I did, and I stayed on through my 20s. My journalism career began there. I'd been studying East Europe history and stayed on and covered what happened thereafter, which was really unpleasant and ended up with ethnic wars and all kinds of disruptions. The effect of that, especially in the more orthodox communist states like the Soviet Union and East Germany, or most troubling in 89, Ceausescu's Romania, was enormously damaging to people. I mean, the fact that individuals were denied not only economic freedom, but sort of freedom to have thoughts that were not the orthodox and approved ones. That it was a constructed and often erroneous, description of what history had been. And that, and even if you remember that that's not what history was, you weren't allowed to say so. It would be dangerous.
Mm-hmm. So,
the same thing with expressing opinion. So, yeah, it created and damaged entire generations of people. Aside from being miserable, it was an enormously destructive force.
How did that happen, though? When we talk about the early or the late 19th century, we had Marxism going into Leninism and devolving into the nightmare that was Stalinism and all that came after that. Was that a matter of how it was conducted, or was that going to happen? I mean, could it have worked better under different circumstances, under different leaders?
Well, one wonders, because Marx, the last place that he would have thought his revolution by the industrial proletariat would have taken place would have been Russia, which ended up exporting it to Eastern Europe, behind bayonets, because Russia was an agrarian place with almost no industrial working class and an entirely different history. But that's the way it ended up playing out. And even in states that weren't like Russia, like look at Yugoslavia. After World War II, also had a socialist regime, and the country was relatively industrialized and outside the Soviet orbit. And yet the same thing happened. It seems to be inherent to the system. The flaw is that if you think that the problem is that private tycoons and individuals are going to rise up and tyrannize people, the idea that you put all power and the ownership of everything and distribution of money, essentially all power in the society, in the hands of the state, what Marx is kind of forgetting is the state is run by people, and people have those same weaknesses, whether they're, running the unchecked power of a state institution or a private one. And so for the kind of unpleasant side of human nature, some of the more ruthless people end up kind of developing the system to benefit themselves and damage others. And that's what happened in Yugoslavia and also in the Soviet bloc, and led to people like Milovan Jelash, writing the great criticisms from the inside. He was a Yugoslav communist who fought against the fascists and helped create Yugoslavia and was supposed to be the Yugoslav leader, Tito's successor. And he was just appalled that, for instance, the Yugoslav Communist Party wouldn't allow rival socialist and communist parties to contest it in an election and that kind of thing. The actual, democracy being taken away and accumulation of power. Unchecked power tends to, lead to unchecked corruption. And when you place all power unrestrained in the hands of the state and remove other actors or even criminalize them, that's usually a recipe for human nature going amok, and that seems to have been what's happened in our historical experience with socialism and orthodox socialism.
If you just joined us, Colin Woodard is my guest. American Character, the title of his latest book, A History of the Epic Struggle Between Individual Liberty and the Common Good. Woodard traces in the book centuries of American history, world history, in search of that sweet spot between libertarian and collectivist. Let's talk for a moment about the other extreme, individualism. And you focus here on Ayn Rand, who came to the West as a refugee fleeing from the Soviet Union. Tell us about how she fits in and why extreme individualism doesn't seem to work.
For sure. Let me do it the other way around and say that if you started at the middle and you're working your way in the other direction into individualism, you'd enter libertarian grounds, and eventually you'd start heading into an area where your argument is that the government is the prime possible oppressor, and if there were less government and less taxes and less regulation, there would be more freedom, meaning more individual freedom and autonomy, and that would turn out great, except that's true if you live in a very collectivist place, that as you have less taxes and less government, you'll have more freedom. But you pass over the middle spot and you'll see diminishing returns and then rapidly see freedom depleted, because what actually happens is that a few families start maximizing their freedom. And if there's no common good government entity there to act as the referee to keep economic competition fair, and indeed intergenerational competition between the rest of us fair, because even if we all started equally to go duke it out in a merit-based competition that America is supposed to be about, after a few generations, a few families would have many advantages and start curtailing the others. So you have all these leveling institutions. But if there's less and less government, less taxes to support it, those things start disappearing, and you have enormous concentrations of freedom and power in a few hands, and you start heading down into a realm that leads to oligarchy. And Ayn Rand was articulated a very radical libertarian philosophy that said not only is it good to have as small a government as possible, but that civic mindedness and altruism are, you know, literally evil and evil forces. And so you take that kind of approach and you're actually headed not towards a paradise of individual freedom, but a situation like today's, you know, Guatemala or El Salvador or Honduras, where a few families, you know, the 10 families or the 8 families, depending on what country you're in, have basically maximized their freedom. They land and the businesses and the army and the courts and the government, and will be to anyone who crosses them. They're some of the most awful places to live in this hemisphere today. So either direction leads to really bad outcomes for freedom. That's why logically there must be a point in the middle where the two are in balance and you actually maximize universal individual freedom.
Okay, so let's talk about that. We have about 5 minutes before we take a short break and come back with Colin Woodard. But address that. If sustaining freedom is a matter of balancing these two things that you focus on in your book, individual liberty and the common good, where is the sweet spot? How do you find it?
Right. Well, one tricky thing is that every society is going to have a little bit different one. Japan's has a liberal democracy, but their emphasis is much more on the individual's responsibilities to the group and social harmony than Americans would be comfortable with. Many West European countries went the social democratic route as being their middle, which again, Americans through our history have been uncomfortable with that level of communitarianism. So the question is, what is our sweet spot? And one of the things the book talks about is the reason we don't know, or we have an enormous argument about it in a way that Japan or West European countries or other countries that are essentially unitary nation states where, you know, it's one ethnic and cultural, you know, formation had created the state and there's broader consensus, you know, Norway or Japan or France or the like, than there is in the U.S. because we're a federation of very different regional cultures, each of which is almost like a stateless nation in and of itself, which is the topic of my prior book, American Nations. You had me on the show a while ago talking about that.
Right. And Iowa is part of the nation you called the Midlands.
Yes, almost entirely, and is in fact the most Midland of nations, and Iowans will probably not be surprised that that is the closest to the middle point on these kind of arguments of all of the nations, but those surrounding it have very different ideas. For instance, the northernish tier above you that would include Minnesota and stretch back over the upper Great Lakes, Western Reserve of Ohio, upstate New York, and back to New England was originally settled largely by New Englanders and their descendants. And they brought with them this sort of Puritan idea of that we are here, and the Puritans were originally here to build a more perfect society here on Earth. It was a group enterprise. The danger to freedom was seen as human avarice, that one individual somewhere in the group would rise up and become an aristocrat or a tyrant. So you had to suppress individual avarice in order to protect group freedom. So it's a very you know, more communitarian, collectivist, community freedom role to yourself in the part of Missouri that you're adjacent to, and on into the Ozarks and the southern tiers of, say, Illinois and Indiana and Ohio and on into the Appalachian Mountains, the greater Appalachian culture that is entirely the opposite. That was founded by people from the borderlands of Britain, the lowlands of Scotland, the English marches, and Ulster, who'd been fighting, living in warlike conditions, where you had to protect your kith and kin yourself. And if government showed up, it was usually a bunch of guys with lances trying to mow down your family. So the, you know, nothing good will come from government was the historical experience of the Scottish and others who settled that zone. Mm-hmm. And they brought with them the emphasis that freedom is about the freedom of the individual and individual autonomy and the orderly, efficient government that, say, the Yankees would aspire to was considered in and of itself a threat to freedom. And the Midlands kind of lie in between. But what I'm saying is that because all of these different cultures have a different sweet spot, identifying ours is complicated because you have all those factors. You have to figure it out in aggregate. And the book does that and explores it. But it's building a coalition between regional cultures that do not see eye to eye at all on where the balance point lies,
okay,
which explains our tumultuous history.
We have a couple minutes before we break, but tell us, why do we then, as outlined in your book, illustrated in your book, we swing from one to the other? We have a period of national liberalism from the right, starting at the Great Depression until the late 60s, and then we go into another period. Why do we swing collectively, it seems, as a nation, even though we are 11 nations?
Right, because over what our experience has been, our politics are usually that there are two coalitions that form. They didn't used to be synonymous with parties, but you'd have trans-party coalitions that would succeed in having enough oomph on, you know, these several regions would get together and they would have enough oomph to push forward an agenda because they controlled the Electoral College. They'd have a filibuster-proof Senate majority and they control the White House. And if you do that together for decades at a time, you're able to push forward an agenda. And at different times, there's been a different coalition that's formed. And at other times, you've been in a situation where neither bloc is articulating a platform or agenda that will win over enough of the other regions. You know, if they have a strong coalition, they need to win over the swing regions, of which the Midlands and therefore Iowa are very much a part. And then we're living in a time period where neither the, well, you can now call them the Democratic and the Republican blocs, but neither bloc has a regional majority. And so we shift back and forth like a pendulum rather radically because neither has the oomph by themselves to do it, and neither is making an argument that will successfully and reliably win over new regional partners to their coalition.
Just a few seconds before we break, where are we right now as that pendulum swings? Are we swinging toward collectivism or individualism?
Well, since 1980 and the Reagan Revolution, we have certainly been on the individualistic side almost continuously. That's since the collapse of that Greater New Deal order, that national liberalism that ran through Truman and Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, and really on through Nixon in 72. But from 1980 onwards, they've been moving towards, if we deregulate, if we reduce taxes, mm-hmm. if we increase the individual's initiative, that things will be great. And that was a compensation against national liberalism, but the pendulum has swung in that direction quite far for quite a long period of time. And okay. Some of the civic pathologies that you would expect to see from that, from history, we are indeed seeing in terms of inequality and distrust of the political system and
okay.
concerns about those kind of matters.
We have to take a short break. Award-winning writer and journalist Colin Woodard is with us. His new book, American Character, A History of the Epic Struggle Between Individual Liberty and the Common Good. We'll be back in just a moment. In the second half hour, we'll bring him into the contemporary era to see how his themes in his book match up with what we're seeing in the election cycle today. It's River to River. It's midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, talking today with award-winning writer and journalist Colin Woodard. His new book, American Character, A History of the Epic Struggle Between Individual Liberty and the Common Good. So we're looking at the centuries of American history, also tying it into world history in search of a sweet spot between libertarian, the individualist tendency, and the collectivist tendency, the common good. And where is the sweet spot? And where has this American nation been? Or I guess because we're talking with Colin Woodard, where have these 11 American nations been all over the map in our several hundred year history? If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Let's pick up to where we were just before the break, if we could, Colin. We talked about the Reagan Revolution being the pendulum heading from in the 70s into the 80s with Ronald Reagan, very individualistic tendencies coming swinging back. But then in your book, you mark 2008 as a turning point call that chapter Rise of the Radicals. What's happening there up into the present?
Right. Well, in 2008, the financial collapse and, to a lesser degree, some of our foreign policy misadventures at the end of the aughts had created a situation where, after the collapse, you had that rise of the Tea Party and the enormous anger at the Republican, congressmen coming back from their summer break and then lashing out in many, many directions. And it was essentially an argument that became, again, the dangers being that there's not enough individual freedom. Most of the Tea Party agenda, as it came about and was formulated, ended up being about, yes, less government and less taxes will be more freedom, even though we were pretty far along down that axis already. And that was expressed in Congress with the coming of the Tea Party caucus and even more sort of radically individualist libertarian members in the Congress than had been there before. And that event, that the 2008 shock to American society, definitely pushed us into areas where we're getting further and further from the center line and where you're seeing more and more dangers to the stability of a liberal democracy.
Mm-hmm. So what, taking this lens that you've created in this book, American Character, take a look at our current political season. What do you see?
It's been fascinating. I mean, I expected while writing the book and finishing it up last year that when the book came out, whenever it did, that issues that can be understood in individualistic versus common good forms would be front and center, because they always are, be it gun control or the abortion debate or whether or not Apple should let the FBI into their cell phones or whatever it is. It's often there. But what I did not expect is that you would actually see the parts of the book that are looking at the fundamental foundational arguments, that you need to understand what a liberal democracy is and how you maintain freedom. I didn't think that those would suddenly in 2016 be relevant parts of the debate from the election cycle. Mm-hmm. We're seeing two things, and we're, the remarkable rise first of Donald Trump, who's, he's funny enough on the spectrum I described. He's much more in the middle than most of his Republican rivals in that, even when there were 15 of them, all of the other Republican candidates were more on the, individualistic, less government, less taxes will be more freedom side than Trump. He was the one candidate of the bunch who was not promising to cut anything in particular about cutting taxes or programs. And in fact, was speaking against the sort of orthodoxy of the party in both trade and in immigration, and talking about how the bankers in 2008 had gotten away with things. So in that respect, he was much more into the middle of the spectrum. The dangerous part was, of course, he's not playing by the liberal democratic playbook, in that he's speaking not for the American people as his constituency, but for sort of the good Americans. And that's kind of send you down the road of the far right wing nationalist party rhetoric in Europe, where you're defending the good Hungarians or the good Germans or the good Poles against the traitorous other in our midst. In Europe, that's the Jews, the Gypsies, and the dirty foreigners. But in here, with Trump, it's been Muslim Americans and Mexicans and those awful journalists in the press pen and whoever made fun of him on Twitter last night. And for those people, that constitutional and legal norms need not apply. Beat them up. I'll pay your legal bills. That's very troubling, that you would have that appear on the American landscape and have enough of a constituency to make the likely nominee of one of our parties, that's kind of unprecedented in American history. So that's one element. And then on the other side, of course, is Bernie Sanders, a avowed social democrat, being highly competitive for the other party's nomination. And remember, I mentioned that social democracy has always been a bridge too far on the collectivist side for Americans, and yet Bernie Sanders has done quite well. And I have a hypothesis about that that goes that many of his supporters are young. They're from the millennial generation. And like, I guess, probably you and I as Generation Xers or the baby boomer generation and people who are older, we went through the Cold War. And the rhetoric of the Cold War, whether you believed it or not, but the rhetoric was that social democracy, you know, equals socialism, equals, you know, communism and Stalinism, that that's all a slide down into the tyranny of the terrible, you know, enemy in the superpower struggle we're in the middle of that has nuclear weapons trained on your home. Mm-hmm. But millennials don't remember that. They weren't around for the Cold War. Instead, I think what happened, part of what may have happened is that Republican rhetoric has sort of boomeranged against them because they in recent years have deployed that Cold War rhetoric of socialism as an evil force on Barack Obama, of all people. And right. Barack Obama on the spectrum is sort of, you know, he's kind of a Teddy Roosevelt progressive Republican circa 1912 or, you know, a Dwight Eisenhower, you know, moderate to liberal Republican, you know, in the New Deal consensus era. And I think a lot of young people looked at that and said, well, if that's what socialism is, it doesn't seem that scary. And essentially, it's taken that negative, you know, charge that word has in American politics for this generation away, which may mean that as they grow older, that there may be movement on that side, that sort of third rail firewall against social democracy may slide a little bit on the collectivist side. But that will be interesting to see in the coming decades if that is indeed true.
Right. How realistic is it to think that if you listen to Bernie Sanders' rhetoric, this is a revolution? How realistic is it to believe that the United States, given it, the society, the culture, the demographics that you outline in 11 nations, that the U.S. could, for some period of time, represent some sort of social democracy akin to Western Europe?
Well, in the short term, even medium term, there's an awful lot of structural reasons that are against it because, as I mentioned, some of the regional culture, Greater Appalachia, the ones I call the Deep South, even the Interior West or Far West, have traditions that are not well disposed towards that. So while somebody like Bernie Sanders might be competitive in certain regions of the country, he's also not going to be very competitive in others on a general election map. You know, if he's up against somebody really unusual like Donald Trump, if it was that matchup, it's kind of hard to say what would happen. But against a more conventional candidate, he would have very little chance of success. But even if he does succeed, you know, the next part of having a revolution would be you'd need to get people elected to Congress who were shared and were willing to further that agenda. And I think if you went through the Rolodex of who's in Congress, you know, it'd be very hard to build a big enough block in the short or medium term for that. And again, you're having to win regions over to do that because congressional districts are sorted that way. So, you know, I think it's not impossible that you would have an evolution in that direction, but I think because the fundamental sort of values and ethos of large parts of our country are strongly individualistic, that's going to be a difficult, at least a medium, if not long-term task and an evolution, not a revolution.
Colin Woodard is our guest. Award-winning writer and journalist, American Character, his latest book. He's written four previous books, including American Nations and the Republic of Pirates. A question from Paul in Des Moines. He emails, on this last point, how is it possible, writes Paul, that in 2008, after Wall Street excess nearly collapsed the entire world economy, all of our popular anger would go against government and not corporate America, asks Paul.
That's a good and rather sad question. Go back over that recent history and re-experience it in detail to understand how that happened. And essentially, the rhetorical and emotional move, and a lot of well-funded groups played a role in trying to shape the anger that was coming from the grassroots that became the Tea Party movement. And the play was essentially that the red-hot anger came after the insurance giant AIG they got a huge bailout and were rescued by the taxpayer. And the very division that had basically brought down this huge, you know, entity and nearly, you know, damaged the entire world economy, the people in that division, Connecticut, were given enormous bonuses individually because apparently their contract sort of required it. And the government basically said there was nothing that they could do. And the anger of that is what really fueled the first big Tea Party spontaneous protests across the country. And that was able to be, the idea was that the government was basically colluding with and coddling the people who had destroyed the economy, and therefore the government could be seen as being at fault and you could point at it. So I think that's essentially what happened. And then the argument could come forward that, you know, if there had been less government involvement, then none of this would have happened and stuff. It doesn't hold up well, but the link was there where the handling of the fallout by the government could be seen as nefarious, and therefore you could have the movement take a anti-government stance very quickly.
Colin, let's say you become an advisor to the next president. You're ushered into the Oval Office based on this book and your previous work. What would you say? What would be the takeaways for our current political leadership?
Well, I think one of the most important things is that, you know, in looking for where that sweet spot lies in aggregate for the whole country, despite our regional differences, where you can get a lot of the regions in agreement and a wide supermajority of the American people, is the idea that, okay, yes, we're Americans, we like having this competition, you know, everybody go out there and do your best and, you know, try to create the best idea and compete against the other people's ideas and businesses and stuff. But we want that competition, that struggle, to be a free and fair one. And to do that, you need to have a referee out there who's able to keep the economy fair and the competition free and not have monopolies form and the like, but also to keep the social realm fair, where a generation down the road, somebody who's born disadvantageously still has some kind of shot at being able to realize their potential. That's why you need to invest in public schools and public universities and healthcare and even highways and infrastructure, parks and libraries. It's all about fairness. And if you conceive of the mission of government to be ensuring that you have people's backs as they go out in that great American competitive struggle by making sure it's fair and making sure that cheaters don't cheat, you're on pretty solid ground with most Americans. And that's the general framework that I think would be of value to people in conceiving of the government's role and how to balance in the American context that preservation and cultivation of the freedom of the community and those institutions that support that, with the ultimate goal of having individuals have a good shot at realizing their potential and have this dynamic society that America's, you know, kind of always been and probably always wants to be.
Colin Woodard with us in the last few minutes. His latest book, American Character. What would you say, though, the other character of our current political time, this hyper-partisanship, the political deadlock, does your study of this area offer any guidance there as to a remedy, a way out to a more common good being pursued by more of our elected officials?
Yeah, well, history has always been, you know, you have these two blocks that always form around, one forms around one nation, the Deep South, which is very laissez-faire libertarian, and the other forms around Yankeedom, which is more communitarian. It's because those two cultures have always had an aspiration to lead the country and have a strong leadership that's always tried to do that. So since the 1830s, you've had shifting coalitions, and what's happened is one or the other of those coalitions at times builds a supermajority and isolates the other, because those two big chunky entities on the American map don't have, you know, short of an external threat, don't have much in common and aren't going to see eye to eye. So it's about building that kind of coalition to succeed, go forward. And yes, you can do it. And some of the things I just described a few minutes ago are the pathway that get you having, you know, three quarters or four fifths of the country's map basically in accord with the philosophical idea and reasoning behind your policies. So I think that is sort of the path forward to be able to get around the deadlock. Because as long as we're deadlocked with two political formations that are rump entities that don't have enough power on their own, the frustration of the fact that nothing moves forward for either grouping, their base gets more and more upset that nothing is getting done from their respective agendas, you start moving towards wanting people who will act more and more uncompromising and more radically. And that's not a healthy thing for the Republic, because the Founding Fathers, being from different regional cultures and not trusting one another, built a system that requires compromise. You can't. It's mm-hmm. not a parliamentary system like in Europe. You have to send your representatives, and they have to compromise with each other out there, because there are so many checks and balances. And when you're in a situation where we are so polarized, that does not happen. The federal government is paralyzed, and that's not a good situation for us or the world to be in.
When you look back over American history, do you see that this hyper-partisanship of the current times has to come to an end? Can it be sustained for decades, or does it have to reach a point at which it turns back into more of the politics that we would have had, where Democrats and Republicans are finding more common ground in the 70s and 80s and 60s?
Yeah, at least, as I said before, it didn't used to be that ideologies and parties were sorted, so it wasn't necessarily, you know, in the 1950s, it wasn't necessarily Republicans and Democrats. It was different regional, you had overlap in the middle on a lot of these issues. But yes, now it would have to be parties. And the answer is no, you can't remain in this kind of paralyzed, stalemated situation very long. If you do, then the country becomes more and more imperiled. And we've been through this before. I mean, this is not the first time we've had a polarized stalemate, and the most famous of them was in the 1850s as we headed towards what became the Civil War. So, I mean, the consequences in our past have been much greater than I would expect the consequences to be now, but it can still lead to really, really bad outcomes when you don't have that kind of agreement.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this question. Why do you think any one person tends to feel more collectivist or more individualistic? And is that more nature or more nurture?
Well, it's probably a combination. I mean, in any county or town on the entire map, just, you know, regardless of what region it's in, you're going to have individuals who have the full spectrum of beliefs. The question is, in that culture surrounding them, the sort of unexamined assumptions about how the world should work and what freedom means and all of those things, does the individual feel that, gosh, I'm among like-minded people and this is great? Or do they feel frustrated, like, oh my gosh, why do people around here not see that the XYZ is completely wrongheaded? You know,
or within families you have such disagreements.
For sure. I mean, it's certainly not genetic. The degree to which the fact that you have a dominant cultural ethos out there, you know, the French culture in France, you know, Yankee culture in the Yankeedom part of the U.S., Midland culture in most of Iowa, that ethos has to have some effect on conditioning individuals and families, but you may reject it. It may not, you know, it doesn't determine what the individual is going to be, but it may slant things statistically where you get, because institutional fabric and the sort of assumptions out there are more on one end or the other, it may cause kids as they grow up to be more likely to be one or the other. But that's a question for child development and the transfer of cultural okay. and political values. It's a little outside of my discipline.
Okay, one question that's outside of your book that I noticed, the recent Politico article that you authored. You write often for Politico. In January of 2016, you wrote a titled article, How America's Dullest City Got Cool. You are now a big fan. You're now a big fan of Des Moines.
Yeah, it's a very impressive story. I mean, essentially in Des Moines, you did something that, you know, if you go around other parts of the country, it's hard to believe would happen, which is a bunch of people got together, were worried about the downtown and the fact that people didn't live there. It was more abundant, as you might say, boring. It was affecting recruiting for, you know, for the big insurance companies, and other players there were having a harder time getting talent to decide, yes, I will move to Des Moines instead of Seattle or wherever. And so they brought in somebody, they created a plan that they corporate leaders and the community development people and the arts and culture folks and government and the counties and the state all kind of more or less got behind. And over 30 years, it kind of basically happened without any major opposition, and people were pretty much happy with the results. I mean, that's pretty amazing, because that never happens, and something that scale actually gets executed with, you know, relatively little opposition, hiccups, or regrets. And it speaks to the very communitarian, neighborly ethos relative to many other regions of the country that Des Moines and Iowa clearly has. And just in speaking with people and researching that story, the sort of ethic of cooperation and people working together is something that wouldn't happen in cities in other regions of the country.
Okay, Colin Woodard, we may just have to make you an honorary native Iowan.
Thank you. I have my maternal grandfather's from Primgar in Spencer County, so that's about as close as I can.
Well, there you go. You got it in your DNA. Writer and journalist Colin Woodard, thank you so much for joining us this hour.
Thanks kindly for having me.
American Character is the title of Colin's latest book, A History of the Epic Struggle Between Individual Liberty and the Common Good. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.